that's the Trombones Inc. with J.J. Johnson's Doo's Blues, comprising Eddie Burt, Jimmy Cleveland, Benny Green, Melba Liston, one of the few women on this instrument who's just virtuosa, Benny Powell, Frank Rehak, Bob Alexander, Bob Brookmeyer, Dick Hickson, Bart Varsalona, and all on trombones. Hank Jones on piano, Milt on bass, Ozzie Johnson on drums. J.J. Johnson was an American jazz trombonist, composer, and arranger, and one of the first trombonists to embrace bebop. This was recorded in 1958. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, August the 25th, and funeral services are being held in Ferguson, Missouri, as I speak, for Michael Brown, the 18-year-old college-bound student killed by local police officer Darren Wilson on August the 9th. The Reverend Al Sharpton, fresh from his high publicity march on Saturday in New York, calling for justice in the July 17th chokehold death of Eric Garner, is officiating. The Garner and Brown police-involved killings have come to crystallize long simmering tensions about police conduct and undue use of force in American, in African-American and Latino communities. But both cases also are being carefully choreographed by Sharpton, not only to shore up his profile as the de facto civil rights leader of Black America, but also as a pivotal political power broker and race intercessor. Sharpton's personal ambitions would be of little consequence, except that the Garner and Brown cases, of great legal significance to communities of color across the United States, are both showing signs of political trade-offs that, in fact, will jeopardize or cancel altogether the very justice that Sharpton is demanding. To date, there have been no legal briefs filed by Sharpton in either of the cases that challenge highly irregular actions by state and local officials in New York and Missouri, nor have any legal actions been taken to compel specific remedies or courses of action that relate to his demand for justice. Rather, there is a troubling coziness with the systems that Sharpton ought to be at war with, and a decided reluctance, if not refusal, to engage in legal battle, which is where the fight for justice really is. Our guest, Alton H. Maddox Jr., is the only attorney in the United States to have succeeded twice in forcing the appointment of a special prosecutor in racially motivated crimes. And he joins us again to help us make sense of the misalignment between what Sharpton is saying and what he's not doing in the Garner and Brown cases. And Alton, it is a pleasure to have you back with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Eutrice.
Well, let's get started. We have going on in Missouri, as is the case when these things blow up this way, we have something akin to a production, a major event, and it's about, you know, the star power that it is attracting, and, you know, the who's who that will be gathered there for the service and so forth. But our focus has always been where it actually belongs, which is what is happening outside of all of the publicity and the great production, the Cecil B. DeMille production that is going on, outside of all of that, where is the rubber meeting the road in terms of not just chancing, leaving to chance the outcome of these cases, but actually compelling the outcome, the desired outcome in these cases, and that in fact involves legal battle, it seems to me. But let's start with some good news, and maybe you can help us with that, and that is the release of Ramsey Orta, the young man who had videotaped the chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, and immediately after that, he was removed and taken into police custody on a charge of gun possession, the gun said to be an unloaded gun, and a bail of $75,000, seemed to be excessive at any rate for such a charge, was imposed. He happens to be, as you had said, a key witness in this trial, and his videotape could not really be admitted before a grand jury without him there to testify as to its authenticity and also as a material eyewitness. What has happened since we last talked?
You're right, absolutely correct. It was certainly good news for those who are really pursuing justice and for those who are not putting the cart before the horse for Ramsey Order to be out from prison in this very tragic chokehold death of Eric Garner. There's no question about it that the situation is one in which there could be absolutely no justice at all for the family of Eric Garner or for black people in general. And that is the suppression of his testimony. While we have the videotape, it cannot be admitted into any grand jury, and it certainly cannot be admitted into any trial without him laying the foundation for its admissibility. And that's the reason why we took a whole different approach to the Eric Garner case than most of those who marched on Saturday, and our approach was to first put the horse before the cart, and that is to secure the release of Ramsey Order. And, you know, with the good hope and graces of his wife, in particular, Ramsey is out, and I have spoken to Ms. Ortiz, and she and he will be at the Brooklyn Christian Center on this Wednesday evening, at which time that we will be putting together a program for his protection and to ensure that he will be able to testify before the grand jury and also at trial without him or his testimony being in any way restrained.
Is it odd to you that the first legal challenges in this case in Missouri came from the ACLU and not from Sharpton and his group, relating to the release of the officer's name and, in fact, to challenge the right of people to videotape what the police were doing?
Well, certainly it is not in any way surprising because the modus operandi of those who usually try to get as close to the family as possible to make it easy for the police department to move in later is one of always putting the cart before the horse. And certainly in this case, it is sad, however, to recognize that there's a group of attorneys who were there but who chose to be ambulance chasers as opposed to attorneys at law. And one of the things that I have always realized in our community is that we must, among other initial things, have a public interest law firm. And that's the reason why I actually founded the Mega Evers Center for Law and Social Justice. However, it has not gone as I would have liked for it to have gone because the social parasites have beat the black community to the punch, and up until this moment, it has been ineffective. But I think clearly, when you look at the ACLU and you look at the Center for Constitutional Rights and other organizations, you realize the importance of having a public interest law firm. We don't have a public interest law firm, and we also don't have any social engineers. And that's one of the reasons why I have set upon myself, without asking for any permission from anybody, to go back to the practice of law, which I'm licensed to do, and have never done anything to justify the taking away of that license, that I am going absolutely back into the practice of law. I mean, at a time when you would think that there would have been others who would have already been there and would have already had the legal resources to start and continue this fight, that somebody like me who've had no income for 24 years have to pick up the pieces and run with the ball.
Well, I asked a question because it would seem to me that the Sharpton team should have indicated by now that this is not a joke. This is a very serious matter, and they're coming armed and ready for war. And the evidence of that, I would think, is in the paperwork. You're looking for paperwork. What have you done to indicate that you're serious about these cases? I mean, it's quite some time now since the killing of Eric Garner. We going into 6 weeks. We have the killing of Michael Brown being more recent, but still quite enough time has gone by. And I would be expecting, and just this is me, just as from a journalistic point of view, I would be expecting a whole bunch of papers filed right now to indicate A, they want a special prosecutor appointed, or they object to the fact that the name of the officers, I mean, legally, not just getting up and talking about it, but they legally are confronting the system saying, you cannot withhold the name of the police officer. Here's our complaint saying you can't do that. And it's in the interest of their clients, actually. But there's no paper hanging around anywhere that you could point to that said, well, they filed a legal brief making a case against one thing or another. It's just not there.
Well, one thing you just said in the introduction, which somewhat answers this question, it is somewhat sad that after all of these tragedies, you know, I'm the one to be able to say that I was not only the first, but also was the second person ever to secure a special prosecutor in racially motivated cases. And I think that what people have to understand is that in order to have done that, it was more than just simple rhetoric, and it was actually a war with 62 other district attorneys in New York State who formed the District Attorneys Association and who have a personal interest in ever losing in a turf war. So to be able to say that you got a special prosecutor in two cases meant that you had to go against 62 district attorneys, and in addition to that, you had to go up against the New York State Attorney General. And then finally, you had to go up against the governor of the state of New York, none of which are very easy attempts in order to do. And so clearly, you will absolutely be surprised that there's not one paperwork at all. I mean, it is not surprising because people can go back to Trayvon Martin. I mean, as much as everybody said about Trayvon Martin and how much they were interested in Trayvon Martin, if you go into the courthouse in Florida right now and look at the public record, there's only one document that was ever filed for justice in the public record, and it was my document. That's the only one document you're going to find. And I think it's really tragic for people not to realize that if there is no paperwork, there is no real effort to secure justice, because the rules and regulations of the practice of law indicate that there have to be paperwork. I mean, you know, that's a requirement. You cannot practice law without filing papers. And when you fail to file any papers, you have made no effort to secure justice.
Well, it also indicates that you basically are playing within the paradigm of the very system that you ought to be fighting, because if you are amassing all of this power, all of this public power. You're asking people to hit the streets. You're asking people to come out and play their designated role to shore up your cards, not just to beg, not to request, but to make demands. And one would imagine that those demands are not to be made just sitting at a table trying to figure out what the other side would accept. But those demands are in writing. Those demands are court documents that say, this is the sum total of what it is we are fighting for. This is not about, you know, being cozy here behind closed doors.
Well, that's absolutely true. And just to, if people don't really get it, let me just say this. The first document a lawyer has to file in any case is a notice of appearance. Saying, hey, I'm here. I'm the one that's going to be defending the rights of this particular person. That's a legal requirement. So when you haven't filed a notice of appearance, and then you haven't followed it up by some subsequent action in a paper, then you're absolutely playing with yourself. And we must understand what the rules of the game are first before we start hooping and hollering and shouting about people who are nothing but frauds and who are nothing but charlatans, who have no intention at all of doing anything to upset the apple cart.
Just yesterday, the governor of Missouri, Jay Nixon, held a meeting, supposedly a meeting among the members of the Black Caucus of Missouri, and basically he told them, in so many words, they could forget it. Not only is he not going to apply any pressure to the special prosecuting attorney of the county, Bob McCullough, he's going to leave him to do his job. So they didn't even broach the question of a special prosecutor. He's already telling them, forget it about me turning the heat up on the current prosecutor that you have. You'll just have to wait and let him do his job. So this is my point. If you have all this muscle power that is in your town in Missouri, you have Al Sharpton, you have the lawyers, you have, you know, the big contingent, you have all this firepower supposedly descending on your town to get, quote, justice, unquote, in Ferguson, Missouri. And there is nothing there that compels anybody to do anything because there is no demand being made, first of all. I mean, Sharpton has not yet made a demand for a special prosecutor. His lawyers have not made a demand for a special prosecutor. All they've been talking about is we want justice. Nobody knows what that means. And, you know, this young man was killed on August 8th. It is August the 25th. And we have no movement, no legal movement in this case of any great significance. We have people talking, well, the feds will come in and they will investigate and we'll have this one doing this role and promising to deliver a transparent process and all this mishigas, but nothing that is in paper that says we are suing you, the system, we are putting you on notice that these are the minimum demands that we are making here, that these things will happen, and we will see to it that they will happen, and we're going to court. We're going to the mat.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, Utrice, and you're right particularly in this sense. In law school, you can take a course called legal reasoning. And legal reasoning help you to reach a conclusion or an answer concerning a particular problem. And when you have a case of a elected official being a prosecutor, prosecuting the case, and the question comes up, can this elected official be fair and be honest? The approach that you use in determining whether that elected official can be honest, and fair is the use of legal analogy, reasoning by analogy. And what I did, I wrote a letter to the governor yesterday, myself, the governor of Missouri, and people can read it on Facebook, Alton Maddox, and you will see an example of legal analogy in that Facebook page, and where I asked the question, how do we resolve this? And I use a legal analogy, and the legal analogy in this particular case that I have used was, is that if a prosecutor like Bob McCullough, with his background, was sitting in a jury pool and waiting to be challenged by a defense attorney in a case in which a black man had killed a white cop, would McCullough be able to sit on that jury? And when you go through a reasoning by analogy, what you realize is that no defense attorney would have allowed McCullough to sit on that jury, because McCullough's background is such that his own father was killed by a black man. So to allow him to sit on a jury in which he has a real interest with the police department and the prosecution, as opposed to the defense attorney, would be legal malpractice on the part of any lawyer. And it wouldn't take no genius to realize that this person would not be fit on a jury. He would be challenged for cause, and the challenge for cause would be granted. And as well, no judge, no governor should let him sit as a prosecutor on a case such as the one relating to the death of Michael Brown. And so the answer is very simple. That, you know, when you sit there with the governor of the state of Missouri and you are supposed to be an elected official, well, it would seem like somebody in that group would have some ability to reason by analogy. And in reasoning by analogy, the answer would come up in such a way that Governor Jay Nixon or anybody else would be able to refute it. I mean, this is what you have to do. And, you know, the question becomes whether we intend to stand up to white people and to force them into the truth, or whether we just going to simply let them be white and serve as masters, and we will yield to whatever they may say. And this is what really bothers me about Michael Brown's case, because it is not a difficult case in which to get a special prosecutor. Not difficult at all. If you had any lawyer fresh out of law school should be able to handle this case, because there are too many legal arguments that you can present to a court that will force the court to retreat. And this is the approach that Charles Hamilton Houston employed after Plessy versus Ferguson, because what Houston did was, instead of, you know, claiming that there should be integration or whatever, Houston just simply showed how it was not economically to comply with Plessy versus Ferguson, because to have to begin to build new law schools and to make them come up to par is something that should not be done. And eventually, white folks got that, because they realized that there had to be a better approach than simply building new law schools and therefore bringing in more black lawyers than fewer black lawyers that would have been the case if you had just simply left this alone. So I think that there really has to be some real strategy and some real tactics in terms of how you have to deal with white people and a legal system that is absolutely racist to the hilt. And you're not seeing that in Michael Brown, you're not seeing it in Eric Garner, and you're not seeing it anywhere where you have to challenge it. These people can be beaten. The question is whether you have the guts to stand up to them or not. And the answer is Absolutely not. We do not have the guts to stand up to them. We're going to have to let them have their way, and that is what is being played out in Ferguson, Missouri.
You know, it is significant from a historical point of view that just outside of Ferguson, in St. Louis itself, lies the body of Dred Scott. And apparently the Dred Scott decision is of greater significance than most people know in that part of the United States.
Well, there's no question. Mm-hmm.
Dred Scott was buried in Calvary Cemetery in St. Louis. I want to ask about the process here in terms of Sharpton's role. Okay, I understand and I accept, because the elected leadership is just so abysmal across the board, and I know there are exceptions. I'm talking now generally. People feel that they have no faith in the ability of their elected leadership to deliver the desired results that they need, or even the help that they want. So they look to people who are larger than life, and certainly Al Sharpton is one of these individuals who's larger than life, and who in his new incarnation, which is carefully being choreographed by, I'm sure, a whole professional team of how to, in the same way that Barack Obama was carefully engineered to be lifted up before the country as a logical choice, that's the work that is being done with Sharpton now, to lift him up as a logical choice for something. And so far, it's working very, very well. But when, in the days of Martin Luther King, a major event occurs in a town, he would typically come into the town. He would typically bring all the interested parties together. And there would be a meeting of the minds. There would be a discussion as to what is happening and what they want and where this project should go and how best could he be used to get the solution that is desired. Here we have a situation where there's a crash landing into the fray. I mean, a call is made, and he would say that people called me, and that would be absolutely true. People do call him and say, come on, we need your help, and he would respond. But the techniques and the tactics are that he would come in and just, this is my thing, I've got it. This is my project, hands off, go away, I've got it. I don't need anybody else, and nobody else better put themselves in the middle of this. This is my personal project. Now, if that is the case, then handle it that way from top to bottom. You can't have your personal project now and then have the community involved and then make this a community project and use the resources of the community, the people and their time and their sentiments and their financial support and all these other things that go along with it. And then at some point you say, well, you know, we've got this just under control and nobody could tell us what to do. Do you think that there is a window of opportunity here to talk to Sharpton and his team and advise them that they need to really rethink their methodology here, because it is counterproductive to the very thing they say they want? Or do you think that they are following the script that they themselves have written, which is, I am really profiting. I, Al Sharpton, and I, Benjamin Crump, the lawyer, and I, Sanford Rubenstein, the other lawyer in the Eric Garner case, we're doing just fine. This is working really well for us. We don't have any reason to extend ourselves into a legal battle that we don't have either the interest or the time to pursue. The kind of legal battle that you and I have been talking about requires a lot of time, a lot of effort. It will require a lot of money to file papers and to follow through with decisions and so forth. And they don't want that. They don't want those responsibilities. They like the hype. It increases their profile. It enhances their ability to, in the case of Sharpton, to become a pivotal power broker within in the world of politics. He's able now to hobnob with the people who used to think of him as a pariah and who now are looking to him as a, as part of the solution, a political solution. And he now also has a vested interest in playing ball because, A, it increases his importance, and B, there's a lot of money involved in all of this. Is it too late to reach out to Al Sharpton and his team and say, listen, you guys really need to double-check yourselves here. You're losing the end game here. You're losing it because, in the end, when this is over, when all of this subsides, the same thing can happen to another young man tomorrow, and there will be no legal precedent set on which people can rely to affirm their rights. They'll have to start from ground zero all over again. And how often is this going to happen?
You know, one of the things, when you asked me that question, I think you asked it really to the right person, because I think if anybody else had to answer it, those persons may have to employ some hearsay, because they would not have absolute personal knowledge to be able to truthfully answer the question. I think that when you look at a situation like mine, you have to ask yourself, why is it now that Reverend Al Sharpton would never allow the two of us, meaning the person that got him out of all of this mess in the first place, sit in the same studio with him? And the answer is very simply this. I happen to have been there when Reverend Sharpton was wearing a medallion and also wearing jumpsuits. And I happen to also been there when Reverend Sharpton moved from a railroad flat in Brooklyn to a condominium in New Jersey. And I know how that transition was made based on my own personal knowledge. And so I can clearly say that among the things that you talked about earlier about whether Sharpton is susceptible to being scripted or not, for somebody else to write his script and all of that, you know, I can clearly say yes, he is, because I've been there when they wrote the script for him. And told him it was their way or the highway. And so he decided that he would use their way because it's more profitable to what they had to offer, certainly, than what I could have offered or anybody else in the black community could have offered. So under those circumstances, you know, I can clearly tell you that Reverend Sharpton has no intentions of going back, none whatsoever. I mean, he goes to tell this course to the very end, for a lot of different reasons we wouldn't have enough time on this show to talk about, but the answer is no, he does not intend to go back under any circumstances. That he intends to stay where he is, and he intends to do the things that he is doing because they are in his best interest. Not for the best interest of the black community, but they are for his own personal best interest. And that's what we have to deal with. But we are clearly seeing an operation where white folks have clearly bought somebody and have put them back into chattel slavery and now is using them to their own advantage. And that's what we have in Reverend Sharpton. And, you know, I think the quicker that we learn that, you know, the better off we're going to be. Because in the meantime, you know, I mean, Reverend Sharpton bring a lot of talent himself to the table. But in addition to that, the talent that he brings, when you combine that with the power of white people, then you're dealing with a very formidable foe.
And I want to make sure that people understand, when you use white in this sense, you use white in the political sense.
Right.
Because we're talking here about a race-based system. And,
right.
And one of white supremacy. And that's what we are addressing here. Is there
absolutely
no? Is there a hope? Let me ask you directly: are you going to, because of the demand, because of what is obviously at stake here, and because it involves a legal response, a legal fight? Are you? It would require a lot of, because. Well, let me just ask, are you in any way contemplating doing something yourself as in the interest of the public?
Well, I think one is as it relates to Eric Garner, and then we can talk about as it relates to the Central Park Seven, and the overriding motivation for all of that is to provide some legal representation for our community, because we clearly cannot go forward without some legal representation, and we certainly need some political representation as well. I mean, the whole country was fought over the issue of taxation without representation. I mean, that's what this is all about. And so for us to have no legal representation and no political representation, we under no circumstances can really expect to move forward. And that's really what, you know, my interest is now. I have sat on the sidelines, and, you know, I think that people have to recognize that when I was sitting on the sidelines, it was because I really did not have the financial resources, and I still don't have them, but I didn't have the financial resources to get back into the fight, and I didn't have people who were willing, to make any kind of investments in me. I mean, all the while I was practicing law, you treason, I was representing pro bono cases and stuff right and left and defending the black community right and left. Never once was there ever a legal defense fund set up for Alton Maddox. Every dime that I had to spend, I had to find the money myself. I mean, it's nothing else to be said. Nobody can go back and find any time where anybody raised one penny for Alton Maddox. The first time I ever got a dime was when I was barred from the courtroom, and then some people started giving me money then, but I certainly got zero help up until that moment. So, I mean, that tells you really where we are as a people when you consider that, on the other hand, you got this guy, Wilson, who just murdered a 18-year-old, and from the last count, he's already collected over $40,000. For a defense and to provide money for him and any of the person's expenses that he might incur. That shows you the difference between the white community and the black community. The white folks are very serious about maintaining the oppression of black people. We are not serious about lifting the yoke of oppression from around our necks. And that's really where the problem is. It's a question of being serious. And what I was simply to say this, if, when black folks decide that they want to change, then white folks going to change. It's going to be just that simple. You decide you're going to change. You decide that you're going to look at things differently. You're going to decide that you're going to be investors as opposed to social parasites. Then white people going to change. It's just that simple. But until such time as that happens, we're going to always be in this plight.
We'll take a break and come back to your questions for Alton Maddox at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, right after this very short break. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. And your calls at 888-874-4888 for our guest Alton H. Maddox, Jr. From New York, Maat, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
First, a point of clarification. The last CNN report on how much money was raised, not just for his legal defense, but for his to be given to him for his overall well-being was over $200,000. So, okay. I had to step away when he was talking about Ramsey Orta, so I'd like to hear a little bit more about that, his being out and his safety.
Ask him directly, Maat. He's on the air with you.
Okay, and also his wife. We love you, Alton, and we want you to get in the fray. I also want you to clarify, because I remember at one point Sharpton had a number of charges filed against him. If I recall correctly, you turned that whole situation around, and recently today on a show, a lady was suggesting that Sharpton is now a millionaire or working. Yeah, so I'd like to know if he has ever come forward and, you know, sort of propped you up. But the main question is around this stop and frisk and broken windows policy. I wanted to tie in to what you're talking about, because for de Blasio to have put Bratton as a commissioner, who, I mean, this guy was architect of stop and frisk, and if it hadn't been for this petty thing, and I believe that
But it's a loaded question so far,
yeah,
Maat.
Yeah.
So
didn't even have any loose cigarettes on him. But I'd like you to connect this whole thing around the cousin of stop and frisk and broken windows, and I'll listen over the air. Thank you for your work. Love you both.
All right. Thank you as well. First, this summer is 50 years after the New York legislature enacted stop, question, and frisk as a legislative enactment. And actually, it was really inspired by the work of Malcolm X, because this was right before he had been assassinated, and his activities were already becoming well documented and well known. And there had also been rebellions in New York that came after the law was enacted. There was the rebellions in Harlem, and then it went over to Brooklyn. And so there was a lot of turmoil, and that only solidified the belief in the New York legislature that they did the right thing in departing from the Fourth Amendment, in which requires probable cause as opposed to reasonable suspicion. And so, unfortunately, 2 years after that, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Terry versus Ohio, endorsed the legislation that had been enacted by the New York without giving any regard to the Constitution itself. And so now you have a deviation from the Constitution to reasonable suspicion, which is required by Terry versus Ohio. And so, in that regard, the next thing that what Bratton did was he came to New York and said, well, I'm going to use that to our benefit by under the broken windows theory. In other words, any minor offense needs to be attacked by the employment of stop, question, and frisk, because now you don't need a crime. You can really deal with any offense in order to invoke stop, question, and frisk. And this particular policy has led to the death of many black men, including Michael Brown and Eric Garner.
Thank you, Maat, for your question. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air with Alton Maddox.
Hello, you three. Greetings to you.
Hello. Thank you. Your question.
And hello to Attorney Maddox. We appreciate all your efforts, and we really do support you, brother. We appreciate you so much. Seems like you're the only voice of reason that's out there now regarding these two cases. And I just had a couple of comments and then get your point of view on it. One of the things that I see that really frustrates me a lot with the black community is whenever you invoke the name of God or Jesus, they seem to put blinders on to everything else. Because the two, it's no accident that the two charlatans and opportunists who always get involved in these cases are called reverends.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my opinion, see, I'm not a Christian at this point. I'm non-religious, but I was raised in the South in the Bible Belt, very Southern Baptist, went to church three times a week, Bible school, and all that. So I know the Bible back and forth. And these two gentlemen do not act in accordance with behavior that purports to somebody who's a true Christian. Now,
the question
in my
quickly.
Opinion, so what I wanted to get your point of view is, why do you think that, because as we know, Christianity and this whole culture and all was given to us by the slave masters, including our last names and everything else. So why do you think, I guess I'm answering my own question, what is your point of view on what we can do when we're confronted with this type of religiosity in these matters, which really should be a non-factor?
Well, I think the answer is somewhat simple, but I think you have to go back into the backgrounds of Reverend Jackson and also the background of Reverend Sharpton and see who they were inspired by and then ascertain whether they are actually walking in or marching in their footsteps. As it relates to Reverend Jackson, you're talking about Dr. King. As it relates to Al Sharpton, you're talking about Dr. Jones. Now, starting with Dr. Jones first, you know, I can clearly tell you that this man was a man of great integrity. And when Sharpton had an opportunity to meet him, he realized that Dr. Jones had a lot of winning formulas. But Sharpton also recognized that those winning formulas could be used for his own benefit. And that's what he chose to do. And I have been in many settings with Reverend Sharpton and Dr. Jones, in which Dr. Jones repeatedly told him, Al, if you eat the king's meat, you must do the king's bidding. I mean, I've seen that so many times. That had no impact, obviously, on Reverend Sharpton because he really saw himself as being deprived and not having finished high school, not going to college or anything like that. He had a great ambition to be accepted by the larger, higher up society, and he had a great ambition to be wealthy. And I think that if you look at Dr. Reverend Jackson, it's the same thing. I have met Reverend Jackson's mother. I've been to their home in Greenville, South Carolina. I know Noel Robertson, the brother of Reverend Jackson, well. And I can clearly tell you that I can see how the same thing happened with Reverend Jackson as well, where they came up, they had great mentors, people that really taught them well, but they chose to pursue their own personal ambitions rather than for the ambitions of their mentor, and that was for our liberation.
Mm-hmm. If I could just have one short follow-up question, how do you think that we can combat this when you're always faced with this religiosity? Just because somebody calls himself a reverend, it doesn't mean that they're acting in accordance with being one. So I find in the black community, when you bring up this type of stuff, they immediately throw the God card in there and just block you at everything you say after that. Do you think it's a matter of getting more information to the black community about what these two guys really are about, or how do you think?
Well, you know, one thing you just said a moment ago, you know, when you said you had been in church three nights a week or 3 days a week, you know, I somewhat trump you there. I also grew up in the Bible Belt. My father, however, was a preacher, and I spent 7 days a week in the church. So I understand the whole dynamic of Christianity and all of that. And I can simply say that in the black community, it takes courage for people to really go beyond the teachings that are prevalent in our community and use those things that we know should be used to advance our people in a way that would advance them. So I think the bottom line is that a lot of people have a feeling that if I'm to be accepted, you know, I must be a part of the norm. And I think there are some of us who, like yourself, who really don't care whether we're accepted or not. We're just out to do the right thing and let the chips fall where they may. And that's the only advice I can give. You know, you just have to decide, hey, am I going to just do the right thing? I don't care whether people like me or not. You know, I know that I'm doing the right thing, and that's where it ends.
Thank you, dear, for doing the right thing. Thank you for your call today. Alton, I want to get to, as we wrap up here, what should the community be bracing for at this time? The funeral is done today, so now we have two funerals accomplished. Okay, the big productions are over. What is to be expected in the very near future with respect to the Al Sharpton's role in these two cases?
Okay, well, as it relates to Eric Garner, I think that's going to be a matter that's going to be clearly embraced by our community on this Wednesday evening at the Brooklyn Christian Center, because our first job is to make sure that we can protect Ramsey Orter and protect his wife, Chrissy Ortiz. I think that's our first step. I think beyond that, then we have to deal with Andrew Cuomo in the same way that we dealt with his daddy, Mario Cuomo, in that instance. I think as it relates to what is going on in Ferguson, obviously that's going to be a little bit more complicated for us because, you know, we are hundreds of miles away from Ferguson, so we don't necessarily have that direct contact. But I think we have to use as much of the knowledge that we have acquired in our struggles here in New York City to transfer that knowledge to Ferguson, Missouri, and where possible, to be able to go out to Ferguson to help them along the way in terms of that struggle there. I think both struggles can certainly be achieved, but I think that we have to do it 24/7. I think that the saying that there must be eternal vigilance is one that we must recognize. It's a 24-hour, 7 days a week approach. The war never takes a time out. We shouldn't take a time out either. And I feel in the end, we have enough in terms of possibilities to make sure that justice is achieved in both Ferguson as well as in Staten Island.
Well, it begins with people understanding that these are not, quote, cases, unquote.
No.
This is a history that needs to be put to rest. This is a history, a very long history, and it is pervasive. It is amazing to me that the major media today, you see stories talking about, oh, wow, look at what we discovered. Well, Chief, we've been saying this for years. It's good that you're now discovering it, but the question still remains, where have you been? I mean, how could you possibly consider yourself a media operation in a country like the United States? And this is news to you. I'm glad that some folks are beginning to wake up and say, well, gee, we had no idea that this was so pervasive and so profound. At the same time, it tells its own story about the racial bifurcation of America.
Well, it certainly does, and like you said before, we learn a lot, and we must use those things that we have learned in order to move forward in the future. And I think that it's an issue of whether we as a people want to either change our habits, change our approach, or whether we want to stay where we are. If we do change, other people are going to change. If we have to stay where we are, nobody's going to change.
Well, great words of wisdom. Thank you so much for being with us today, Alton, and for, again, bringing light to this complex question as to what it is that the community needs to do, and how does a community see its own rights to involve itself at a different level in both these cases.
And that's true, Eutrice, and I want to remind everybody, you know, I'm writing every day because a large part of this is education. A large part of it is from the teachings of Kwame Ture and others who have said that among most everything that we need as a people, political education right at the top. And I'm spending a lot of my time doing exactly that on Facebook, Alton Maddox, and on www.realestatealtonmaddox.com.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Stay tuned.
Coming right up is The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me via email at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. I want to thank you so much for being with me today. I also want to let you know that this week, today's wake up call. I am so sorry. I'm thinking of today's wake up call, not Infectious Myth, but wake up call with Richard Martin. Let's keep talking. This week, I'm going to extend the conversation because I've gotten extraordinary feedback and a huge volume of emails which suggest that people really want to talk about this case, these cases, but also to talk about the issues that are raised. And it's enough of a hint that we really need to set aside some time to talk. So we'll have extended time this week to talk. Thank you so much. A pleasure and a privilege, as always, to be in your company. Keep it right here. Richard Martin, Wake Up Call is next.